This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Supreme Court, a decision temporarily put aside with a temporary restraining order by a judge in Massachusetts, sounds dry. It's not. This is birthright citizenship, and Professor Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute, teaching law at NYU and the University of Chicago, has written about birthright citizenship for many months now. But here one more time, just when amateurs such as myself thought the issue was settled by the Supreme Court by saying a federal district judge only has the authority to issue a temporary restraining order on the case in front of him, on the people represented before his court, not nationwide, has ignored that Supreme Court or has stepped around that Supreme Court decision, which I'm not sure. Professor, a very good day to you. I read from the report most recently at USA Today. So no particular dog in this fight. A federal judge again barred President Trump's administration from enforcing his executive order limiting birthright citizenship nationwide after the Supreme Court restricted the ability of judges to block his policies using nationwide injunctions. U.S. District Judge Joseph LaPlante in Concord, New Hampshire, made the ruling July 10th after immigrant rights advocates implored him to grant class action status to a lawsuit they filed seeking to represent any babies whose citizenship status would be threatened by implementation of the president's directive. LaPlante agreed the plaintiffs could proceed as a class, allowing him to issue a fresh judicial order blocking implementation of the Republican president's policy nationally. Professor, simply put, I'm flabbergasted because I presumed that the Supreme Court had the final word on these matters. Can you help me understand what LaPlante is thinking? Good evening to you.
Yes. Well, there were some words in there which says if this were a class action, the outcome might be different. And once the Supreme Court put that word in the thing, everybody said, well, now I'm making this a class action. But if you're talking about representation, there probably are two real individuals, say pregnant women who are illegal aliens in the United States who want birthright citizenship for their children. And then everybody else is somebody who's anonymous. The real issue was not the question as to where the people are distributed. The real issue is, shall a single district court judge sitting in one location bind the entire nation? And that problem remains even if you recast the case from an individual suit to one of a class action. And so I think it's just a rather crude effort to circumvent the original order. And if I were the Supreme Court, I would strike this thing down. In fact, I would probably take out all the language on class actions or modify it as follows. You may, in fact, have a class action and you may represent that class action, but only for people in New Hampshire or the district in which you sit. And if you're a circuit court, you could only do it for the circuit, in that case, the First Circuit, in which you sit. But in neither case can you change a particular dispute, the merits of which are exactly the same here as they were previously, and now get the preliminary injunction by adding in a bunch of people whom you could later drop from the suit so that it's all a sham. What's going on in this particular case is that there's a deep division of opinion in this country. There are some people, I'm mainly conservative, libertarian, myself, who are deeply skeptical of the arguments in favor of birthright citizenship, and I've done a huge amount of study on it, which I'm quite happy to share on some other occasion. And then there are the four courts that are absolutely gung-ho with this. So if you read all the opinions that were issued in February after the executive order came out, they all basically said the same thing. Birthright citizenship has been established. We know from the beginning of time it's been ratified by the State Department. It's been verified by various sorts of scholars. There's the Wong Kim Ark case, which does all of this stuff. We think the case is so utterly overwhelming that we're going to do this. And you go four for four. This, I think, is probably what happens, because remember, in these situations, you know that the Republicans, not all of them, but many of them are going to be hostile. The Democrats, virtually to a man and a woman, to go the other way around. You have the power to pick the particular jurisdiction in which you want to go and have a good shot of getting the judge that you want. And if you can do all of that, then what happens is your first mover advantage makes this thing work in your particular favor. Now, I've read those decisions, and I think they're extremely poor on the merits. Some of them are laughable. Others of them are more serious. But what's about all of this stuff is it's very clearly an ideological trumpet that's playing on these cases. And you could see it in this situation. And the ACLU is supposed to be an ideological organization. And the fact that it plays that role is fine. The courts are not supposed to be an ideological organization. It's supposed to be a little bit more, circumspect. And so I would hope that the Supreme Court would strike down this effort and say that we have the traditional rules, and bringing in a bunch of plaintiffs who don't really matter for anything that's before you is not a way to convert what would be a local injunction into a nationwide.
I want to read the White House's response. This is Harrison Fields. Today's decision, the court's, LaPlante's decision, is an obvious and unlawful attempt to circumvent the Supreme Court's clear order against universal relief. This judge's decision disregards the rule of law by abusing class action certification procedures. What is that, Professor? Here's why. It occurred to me that they're making a claim to represent unborn children and pregnant women across the nation without ever having asked their permission. So that means a class action suit becomes absurdly grandiose. Could you claim a class action suit for every living thing in the solar system? How far can they go on this?
Well, it used to be when you had class actions, and there were very elaborate rules with respect to certification. There had to be opt-out provisions that were going to be allowed and granted. And there may well be some women who are in this particular class who actually are not in favor of birthright citizenship and plan to only take the citizenship of their own country. No, it is clearly an abuse, because the argument that the government is making, and I think it's a correct one, is we hedge in class actions with all sorts of very powerful procedural and substantive limitations, and it takes a very long time to get class certification. And in a case like this, where there's no common good, it's much harder to do it, because this is just an aggregate of individuals. The cases where class actions turn out to be quite important is you have an organization and it's been attacked. And the question is, if this organization goes down, there are going to be huge problems. And you want to make sure that the class action includes everybody who's involved with this particular organization, whether it be a charitable organization or some kind of a corporate situation, so that there can be a suits either brought by it or against it, in order to make sure that all the people who are necessarily connected with one another are there. That's not what's happening here. This is a class action, what they call a C3 class action, in which there are lots of people who are on a bus, and the question is, do they all get to become part of the same action? And you start off with the notion is, well, how many common facts are there amongst these various parties? And they're usually very long and elaborate deliberation. This state, the judge simply did not care about any of the law of class action. What he cared about was getting the preliminary injunction, and so this was a device.
So it's a stunt. The judge knows that everything you just said.
This is basically that. And, you know, look, the Trump lawyers, it's a very mixed bag, like everything else. You know my maxim about Donald Trump, a la carte, and you have to take them all. I've read the executive order, and it's actually a very good executive order in terms of the way in which it was done. And let me just mention a couple of things about it. One is, he doesn't try to order everybody else to recognize this. He says, I'm in charge of the executive branch, and I believe that this is the appropriation, and I'm going to follow that until the Supreme Court tells me otherwise. This is not, like many of his other actions, a barefaced intrusion in other people's lives. It's not like the way in which he cuts off grants, for example, to universities. It's a big difference on that. And secondly, he expressly exempted from the order any person who obtained birthright citizenship before the final adjudication in this case. That is, he's not trying to undo the past. He's simply trying to stop the future. And it seems to me he's perfectly within his rights to try and do that stuff. And you happen to have a debate on the merits. I've read so many pieces which are simply dreadful on this. And let me just mention one technical point, which shows you the Constitution has two phrases. They're very different. One in the Citizenship Clause says, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And the other in the Equal Protection or the Due Process Clause says, within the jurisdiction. Now, those are not the same words. Obviously, they use them differently. What's the important? Well, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States means, in effect, that you have exclusive loyalty to the United States, not otherwise. within the jurisdiction said, you're here from somewhere else, and to the extent that you're in our country, you have to obey our traffic laws and stuff like that. But it's not a citizenship claim. The moment you leave the country, the United States has no control over you. So the two phrases were used in deliberate opposition to each other when this thing was formed. And what happens is every single judge has treated two things that were opposites as though they're synonyms. That's the kind of stuff that you're dealing with. And I just find it absolutely baffling to watch the way in which they mangle the history when these things start to come up. Or to give but another illustration, Wong came off, very complicated case. It was somebody who was subject to Chinese jurisdiction, so should have been excluded.
This is the original case from the 19th century.
In the 1898 case. But the other point about it is this man was a permanent alien and was legal. And the opinion does not have a single word about illegal aliens in it. What it does is it gives a rather overbroad reading of what happens to people with permanent residence. In fact, inconsistent with the Naturalization Acts at the time, which was not really addressed fully by Judge Horace Gray, who wrote it. And so, you know, that's a very contentious case. Lots of things to be said on both sides. But the idea that this is all so cut and dry. Every time I hear people talk about this, you know, the professional civil libertarian, they act as though there's only one side to this particular
thing. They read it in contempt of anybody who challenges their opinion. I've heard it again and again on the radio.
And let me just give you one other fact, the last one. One of the rules that existed in England going back to 1480s and so forth was that if you're a foreigner, you cannot bring suit in English courts to recover real property. And that rule has been uniform and has been carried over to the United States. So if you are a child and you were born of an alien, you could not sue to recover property on inheritance, even if somebody actually had left it to you. Do you really think that the rule is that you can sue to recover real property, but you're a citizen from birth? Well, if you're a citizen from birth, then the whole thing makes no sense because you don't have the problem.
All right, but I want to focus on the judge's authority. Why did he do this, knowing that what you say has been established already? And the Supreme Court, what is the mechanism of the Supreme Court? Does it discipline the judge for?
I think they just basically reverse the order.
And
on the grounds that it's an abuse of authority.
And they tell the judge what? A federal district judge, isn't he subject to the discipline of the court?
You're not the discipline, you just reverse the order. And you put some harsh words on there, but it does show a real willingness to politicize these kinds of decisions on issues of this sort. And the whole birthright citizenship case has been subject to an enormous amount of stuff, which is sort of very overtly political.
So it is your opinion that the judge's 7-day pause will be extended. White House to appeal, that this will just continue the debate indefinitely until there's a rendering by the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court could end this by ordering the judge to reverse himself.
Yes. And remember, the Supreme Court was very explicit in its order that none of the merits of this particular case are anywhere on the table.
All right, let's go.
And that was the right result.
We have another matter for the Supreme Court.
Okay.
This is whether the President of the United States, the head of the executive branch, is permitted to separate people from the executive branch, a.k.a. fire them. Yes, that's right. Can a boss fire the people he hired? Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.